You have somebody like Drake, who I'm sure everybody thinks, oh, you know, yeah, he must be number one across all these stations. These stations don't even play Drake like that. They still stick him in CanCon so that, you know what I mean, he can service their other needs to say, yeah, you know what I'm saying? Like, we did play some black artists. Look, we have Drake and Weeknd. And even though these are some of the biggest artists in the world, they're still doing better in other territories than they are in their own home territory.
So welcome back to another episode of the infamous, or should I say world famous, Black Tea Podcast, hosted by yours truly, Dalton Higgins, and the lovely and talented Milena Williams. How's it going, Mel?
Great. I'm really excited about this interview.
Oh, this is going to be lit fire. Now, as you know, Mel, I like to say that it's a hip hop world and you all are just living in it. And so we are especially geeked to have a hip hop pioneer join us on today's show. We have the one, the only Mr. Cardinal Official here.
Bop, bop,
Cardinal,
bop,
air horn, bop, bop, noise, bop. Make some noise. Where's the air horn? Right.
Wait a minute. Hold on a second. I was going to say we can't have an interview with Higgy and it's not the real thing. Something in there. Oh well,
that's right.
The horn didn't wake up yet.
Totally. Now here's it. Before we get into it, let me tell you a little bit about Cardinal. I mean, he's a Canadian music icon who really needs no introduction, but I'm going to provide one anyways. Now, Cardinal is a man of many talents. He's a Canadian rapper, record producer, DJ, and he's a record executive, currently working as the senior director of urban A&R and artist relations for Universal Music Canada. Now, Cardinal is often credited, you know, as being Canada's hip-hop ambassador, as he was waving the Canadian flag around the world, you know, while on tour way before it became cool, sexy, and trendy to do so. In fact, before the city we're based in, Toronto, became known as the Six, Toronto was always referred to as the T-Dot, and it's a term that was coined by Toronto rapper K-Force, but then popularized by Cardinal. Now, I like to personally call Cardinal Yardinal, like Yardinal, because he is very proud of his Jamaican heritage, right? And he's one of those artists as, you know, he's kind of best known for his distinctive reggae and dancehall influenced style of hip-hop. And Cardinal has won multiple Juno Awards, MMVAs, SOCAN Awards, and he was the first Canadian hip-hop artist to reach the Billboard Hot 100 with his single Dangerous, featuring Akon, which reached number 5 on the singles chart. Cardinal has also worked with and been featured on records with an absolute dream list of artists, including Lady Gaga, yeah, that Lady Gaga, Pharrell Williams, Rihanna, T-Pain, Vibes Cartel, it goes on and on and on. Cardinal also appears on what is, in my personal opinion, one of the best songs on R&B superstar Daniel Caesar's last album. The track is called Cyanide. So what's happening, Cardinal?
Man, I am here being reminded of some of these journeys. Every time I hear some of those names, I'm instantly just taken back to the auspicious scenarios that got me into those into those rooms. And had those things come to life. But I'm good, man. You know, we're here 2020-ing it.
Yeah. So, Cardi, I'm so excited to have you here. So, as Dalton went over just now, you know, you're a hugely successful artist. You've worked with so many other artists. And you really display, I feel like you pioneered the global power a Canadian artist and even, you know, hip-hop rapper can have, building international bridges, you know, US globally. And a lot of the time when Canadians reach a level of success or gain the level of visibility you've had for such a long time, they leave. So I'm just sort of wondering why you've chosen to stay.
I mean, for me, to be honest, me in particular, here's the truth. I didn't stay early out when I got my first record deal. And this is when record deals were at least for people my age, were really ton up. They actually provided a stipend so that I could pay mortgage in America. So I actually split my time between Toronto and Brooklyn for like 2 years when I got my first deal. I don't think it's a widely known thing, and it's not that important, but I never fully left here because for me, my inspiration for the music, like if you... I'm sure we're skipping ahead, but if you go to, you know, Old Time Killing, that was strictly inspired by Toronto energy and Toronto vibe.
Let me tell you a little story about this girl I used to know. Used to come and tell me she love me since me sing on with the show. Say she love the way me represent the whole of T-Dato. Say she love me on the TV, love me.
So for me, if I was to go and live permanently somewhere else, to me, I was like, well, what is my music going to sound like? It's going to sound like every other American. And you have to understand, like, at the time, it's very difficult to understand because it's like there's a generation of people that grew up with hip hop always being on TV, always being in commercials, always having access on the radio, or even more so now, literally on demand, you know, through subscription based access and so forth. Like, we came up at a time where there was none of that. You know what I'm saying? Like, there was literally nothing. So our agenda was very different. You know what I mean? Like, I grew up, you know, listening to the great MC Light, listening to, you know, NWA, Ice-T, listening to everybody under the sun. And everybody was able to, we knew where everybody was from because in some song or another, they mentioned where they're from. You know what I'm saying? One of my favorite songs from MC Light when I was a youth was Kick This One for Brooklyn. And it's like, we used to go and like recite all those lyrics around the neighborhood, but you know, we didn't have anything directly that spoke to Toronto, you know what I'm saying? So that is for me why I stayed, because I wanted to stay authentic. Looking back, you know, it's interesting because I remember those labels, they're like, yeah, you know, we want to, and no disrespect because I think some of these artists are dope, but, you know, they're like, yeah, why don't you do a song with Ashanti, or why don't you do this, or, you know, get a song produced by X, Y, and Z. And I was just like, you know, no disrespect, but that's not who I am as an artist, you know what I mean? And it's like, I wanted to make sure that I could stay as authentic and true to my culture and my music as possible. So that's why I stayed personally.
Now, Cardinal, I want to talk a bit about actually your mother, all right? And
hold on a second. You know, in most places, a man will get punched. You can't just say you want to talk about my mother, bro. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, you know what? I know. I never thought about that, actually. Exactly. Oh gosh. Yeah. Yikes. Yeah. But anyways, yeah, we're hoping people. So Cardinal, I want to talk about your family, your mother in particular. Now, I'm thinking about Donda, you know, the company that Kanye West named after his mother, Donda West, and which shares the same name of his next studio album, right? People are thinking, you know, Kanye West, he's out there in the news, and his mother, paying homage to his mother constantly. I want to talk about your mother's influence on you, because people in the community in Toronto that kind of know you or know of you, you know, when they look at your social media feed and they see these activist streaks, you know, like you've always been quite vocal when it comes to advocating for different causes, including, you know, those of your own Black community. So from what I understand, this is like in your bloodlines. This is your lineage. Can you tell us a little bit about your mom's work in the community?
The same way that kids grow up now and hip hop is just a part of their DNA and they don't necessarily know why. It's just something they can remember as far back as, you know what I mean, coming into the world. And to them, it's very, very, very normal and accessible. That is kind of how my community involvement felt and feels to me. When I was younger, you know, people, we often hear about these latchkey kids and, you know, Caribbean parents working two jobs and so forth to be able to support and properly provide for their kids. The times when I was young, when my mom wasn't there in the evenings, it's because she had community meetings and meetings. And I actually, when I was really young, as you can imagine any small child would, I used to hate when my mom was like, yo, I have a meeting I got to go to, because it meant that whatever, random babysitter would be there and we'd have to yam some pizza for dinner or whatever it is. You know what I mean? My mom, from the time that I was young, dedicated a lot of her life to the community and also to education in particular, because she worked for the Board of Ed, the Toronto Board of Education, as did. Long story short, when my mom came to Canada, because she was not 18 yet, she had to be adopted by her older sister. So my auntie is kind of like my grandmother legally by Canadian terms. But the two of them, my mom and her older sister, both worked for the Board of Education, and we have other educators within the family. I have a, believe it or not, a Black professor uncle that was a professor at the University of Prince Edward Island. Imagine that, who actually is a published author. With all that, you know, all that to say that, yeah, growing up, I just knew community involvement and worrying about your community and so forth. That was just what, you know, what we did anyway, at least what my mom did. So, you know, for me at a very early age, you know, now they call it, well, the word is almost played out, but now they call it woke, you know what I'm saying? But I think my family was woke for decades now. So growing up in that, you know, besides my mom, who was so involved in everything, including the early stages of me actually becoming a professional, because to be honest, she was the one that encouraged me to write my first rhymes, you know what I'm saying, when I was younger. And I think she kind of looked at it as an educational activity, to be honest, because she's like, yo, you're always at the center. You guys are always making up these dance routines. You're rapping other people's lyrics, doing that. She's like, yo, you should, you know what I mean, really try and write your own verses and so forth. So she was actually the one that got me into this. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely started with my mom, who was when by the time I got to grade 7 or 8, she was the Black Heritage teacher back when we still had Black Heritage classes within the Toronto District School Board. But yeah, it started with my mom, and she used to teach all the kids in, you know, in the neighborhood that she taught in, like even on Saturdays. So a lot of people do know my mom from even outside of the traditional school board. But yeah, you know, that's probably what led me to, you know, be a good mentee to people like Motion, you know, people like John Bronski, people like Master T, you know, Oren Isaacs and you know, several other Black people that mentored me along the way. So mom's definitely laid the foundation. And I think it was because of my teachings at home and the way that my mom raised me that I was able to, you know, soak up a lot of the gems that my other mentors were able to give me along the way. And it really helped my career.
Yeah. And she was also, you know, in Toronto, like we had a guest, Sasha Exeter, talk about, you know, she'd attended Howard University, which is a historically Black college and university in Washington.
Don't get me started. And mother, my wife, you know, my wife graduated from there. Don't get me started on these HU people, but sorry, continue.
Ah, okay. Your wife is a Howard University grad as well. Interesting. But even locally, you know, we don't have historically Black college and universities in Canada, but even your mother, she was one of the people working behind getting the Afrocentric Alternative School up and running in Toronto as well.
Yes, yes. Her and Miss Angela are credited with being the two to really go out there and Malcolm and Martin the whole situation, you know? Yeah, I mean, listen, my mom right now, she should be retired. She should be chilling. My mom is, you know, on the phone to this day, still fighting the fight digitally with these boards of education. You know what I'm saying? Like my mom is on it, man. Like she's not interested in putting down the megaphone anytime soon. So she's, you know, she's still on it, even though, yeah, they were able to successfully create the Afrocentric School, which, by the way, I don't know why it doesn't have an actual name and we just call it the Afrocentric School, but that's neither here nor there. But yeah, she's still out there thugging it, man. She's still out there thugging it for the kids. She also actually won the Queen's Diamond Jubilee Award for her anti-violence work and anti-gun violence work within the community as well. So yeah, mom's been putting it down, man. She's a superstar in the social work way, the same way I guess I am on the music side, yo.
Since 2013, you've been with Universal, and I'm really interested in, you know, you working on both sides and that decision to do so. So as a music executive, like, how do you feel that is going to impact your legacy and sort of your journey working for a label? Because it's just so atypical.
I didn't want to work, quote unquote, on the other side initially, if we're being totally honest. I used to be managed by the legendary Bystorm, which is Mark Pitts and Wayne Barrow. And for those unfamiliar, That was the Notorious B.I.G.'s first manager. On the management side, they've managed everybody from Nas to J. Cole, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I was blessed enough to be under their tutelage for some years. And during that time, you know, I remember the opportunity came about through the then president, Randy Lennox. And I was a skeptic, to be honest. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, as Dalton was showing you, like, I was raised by my mom to where it's like we fought the system. We didn't really join the system. Right. So I was like, well, why would I want to do that? You know what I'm saying? But to be honest, those guys, you know, the Bystorm family, they're like, listen, basically, they're like, there is no reason why you shouldn't diversify. You know what I'm saying? Okay. And not just be a one trick pony. Not that I was, but, you know, they're like, listen, the amount of things that you will learn will help you better guide your decisions as a businessman, period. So, you know, there's no reason why you shouldn't go and see what's happening on the other side of the Iron Curtain. And it was between them and Steve and Marley that really pushed me to the other side. I had a studio session with Steven at his crib. And, you know, I was telling him about it and how I was conflicted. And Raga said, yo, to be honest, in order to change the system, we need more people like you inside the system. You understand what I'm saying? Because the system can't change from outside and work within. You got to be able to figure out ways to penetrate so that you can make things better for people like us. You know what I mean? People within the community and so forth. So it was really between, you know, between the business angle of it, from Bystorm, and then also, you know, a combination, I guess, from Steve and Marley. Those two things were the real catalyst that really, I guess, changed the way that I was looking at it. And sometimes you can, you know, sometimes we all have our eyes on the prize, but it looks different depending on what lens you have, you know?
Right. So how have you found it? Like, in terms of your influence on other artists and, you know, being able to push for people like you?
I've come to understand it's a very complex web. And you know how sometimes we can stand up and we can see a spider weave this complex layer of different things. Some people only see it and they're like, yeah, spiders, they catch flies, while other people are able to really analyze what's going on and understand what's really, you know, what's actually going down and the reason for it. And there's levels. The first few years, I'll be honest, I felt like I was there wasting time, just catching an extra check. You know what I mean? Like, I don't feel like I really had the effect that I would have wanted to, because all the ideas that I had were either shot down or I kind of got a pat on my shoulder to say, that sounds nice. Yeah, we'll look into that. And I don't think there was any real movement. But I think there was a lot of growth that happened in my life that was able to kind of have me understand more what the function of the current day Canadian label is all about. And that's important to understand. All labels are not created equal. All of them are not the same. And even within this country, you know, the big three, as they call them, Sony, Warner, and Universal, even those three do things differently. So, you know, it's important to understand the culture of the record labels in order to make the difference. Because the thing is, if you don't even understand how they work, well, then how can you, one, actually participate? You know what I'm saying? If you don't even understand how the business works. And then, you know, once you understand how the business works and why the business works, it's only then that you can actually, you know, start to attack it and use your influence to do some amazing things. So, I mean, in terms of artists, I feel proud because as Dalton can attest, I don't think I can count more than five major Black artists that have had any significant, you know, I don't think I can count more than five maybe that have pushed the needle globally that have signed a deal here. And off top, and this is pre my time in there. So, I mean, before I was there, or even if you want to call it pre-Jazz Cartier, we had who was signed here? Maestro.
Um, Yeah, this long pause is telling.
Yeah,
so, grasping for straws, you know, like it's like who was signed to a Canadian deal? It's like a 5 minute pause.
Yeah,
like,
rascals were.
Yeah, BMG.
By the time I got in there and was able to understand what was really moving, which honestly was, if we're being completely honest, probably the last 3-4 years max. I feel very blessed because the type of deals that I'm involved in are competitive deals, meaning that if you went to America, it's pretty much the same deals that you would be able to be offered in terms of monetary resources, in terms of a lot of different things. And I think that's very important. So it's like, not just culturally now are we starting to see a shift. And, you know, I would be able to point to the most recent one being Emmanuel, who, you know, had zero following, is from London, Ontario. He's an Ethiopian-Canadian artist from London, Ontario, had zero following, zero music out, and so forth. And within a few months, he's closing in on 10 million streams, which for any act, Canadian or American, being brand new, is quite a feat. So, I mean, in the small amount of time that I've been there, I've been able to, in terms of the way that we do business, in terms of the way that we see business, and the type of people that we do business with, I've been able to make a real change. And there's a lot of other things that will be revealed soon. But I feel dope about being able to change infrastructure, because that's the only way that things are going to be able to change for future generations. It's not about just the one artist. It's about changing infrastructure.
In the broader scheme, Cardinal, I mean, you know, in society, like, we're obviously having this woke moment, you know, and it seems that everyone and their third cousin is an activist now. So here's the thing: if you're a rapper, you know, an R&B singer, reggae artist, or you do Afrobeats, you know, in Canada, and you're trying to navigate the Canadian music industry, it's obviously still very complicated, awkward, and scary. And why I say this is, it's just awkward as hell. I mean, I had to do an interview recently about the state of black or urban radio in Canada recently, and I'm big on facts, you know, as far as hard data. And the reality of the situation is that the state of black or urban radio in Canada is far worse than it was in the 90s. So there's a time we had, you know, Flow 93.5 in the 90s, when it was black owned rather. And at the time, you know, when it came to be, there was a fleet of urban stations popping up around the country. And we had that in combination with this thriving campus community radio scene. So there was a lot of radio going on for about an 8-year period. Now, much of that is gone. So without radio support, in Canada, like you referenced some great acts that you're working with, Emmanuel, who has some great music out. You know, it's really tough to make it here, like, commercially, you know, because you kind of need sometimes that radio support. I'm just talking about radio for this instance. Now, so what do you tell, like, Canadian, you know, rappers, R&B singers on ways to make it in Canada, like, commercially, meaning not feeling the need to want to get the hell out of Dodge, like Mel was asking you, you know, like, how do you make it here in Canada and not have this feeling like, okay, Jazz Cardi, he's in LA now. Everybody ultimately leaves or tries to leave. How do we convince him to stay?
I do not. I do not. There is not a way to have a sustainable career yet where you can rely simply on a domestic infrastructure. It just doesn't exist. Anybody, the one of the greatest things was them getting rid of geofencing, which was, remember back in the day on your phone or your computer, you'd go to log in to, you know, to see somebody's video and it would say, video is not available in your territory. You know, they have done away with a lot of that. So right now, what's great is that you put a song out and you're putting it out to the globe. So unfortunately, but to our advantage, we circumvent the entire Canadian industry. There isn't any, support for black music within the radio infrastructure here. And, you know, it is glaringly obvious and everybody knows that. So, you know, it's funny. I was on a call with some successful managers from here that manage some global artists. And, you know, just out of respect for the privacy, I won't mention the artists or them. But I was like, yo, so, you know, artist X, I said, how much radio play do they get here in Canada? They're like, what's that? Radio play in Canada? You know what I mean? Like, you know, anybody that's doing anything of any significance, we're not getting any play here. So, you know, that goes, here's a perfect example from a couple years back. When Melanie Fiona won her Grammy, and then, you know, as we usually do here in Canada, we were like, oh, I guess we should recognize her. So I remember they gave her a Canadian Walk of Fame or whatever. And, you know, I remember her just shaking her head being like, yo, Cardi, they don't even play my music in Canada at all. And I'm sure most of these people don't even know who I am. It's only because I won a Grammy. You understand what I'm saying? And that's been our reality. You know, I spoke a bit about this on that the CBC podcast, you know, where I said, you know, Dangerous was a massive international hit before Canada recognized it. You understand what I'm saying? And that's just been, even though that was 10 years ago or 11 years ago or what have you, it's still the same now. You know what I mean? To where it's like, we all know the controversy surrounding him, but prior to the controversy, you look at somebody like a Tory Lanez, who was doing extremely well outside of the country, you know, before we even acknowledged that he was doing well on radio or any of our other platforms here. So, I mean, it's kind of always been the way. And yeah, I mean, hopefully in 2021, listen, I know that right now there are some independent audits that are going on and they're pulling together, like Dalton was talking about, hard data. Because now that, you know, everybody is woke and the layers are being pulled back, now these guys are being held accountable publicly. So we'll see what happens in 2021 when these guys have to kind of, you know, face up to it. You know, you understand what I'm saying? Like, you have somebody like Drake, who I'm sure everybody thinks, oh, you know, yeah, he must be number one across all these stations. These stations don't even play Drake like that. They still stick him in CanCon. So that, you know what I mean, he can service their other needs to say, yeah, you know what I'm saying? Like, we did play some black artists. Look, we have Drake and Weeknd. But in, you know, if you dig deep, and these are not opinions, by the way, if you dig deep and understand how radio works, you'll understand that even though these are some of the biggest artists in the world, they're still doing better in other territories than they are in their own home territory.
Yikes.
That's scary. Pretty shameful.
It is, but we've been walking around like with this shame for years.
So Cardinal, I wanted to talk to you about your relationship with the comedian Dave Chappelle. I mean, we obviously all know Chappelle. He's best known for his satirical comedy sketch series, The Chappelle Show, and doing stand-up. And for those, you know, people out there that on your social media feed and they know, you know, they're watching your career, they see that, you know, you've performed at his events, you've DJed his events, you've hosted parties for him here in Toronto, the Toronto International Film Festival. So can you talk about that relationship? Because Dave Chappelle is arguably, I mean, last year he won that prestigious Mark Twain Prize. I think you were at the ceremony. Can you just talk a little bit about, give us some nugget, some anecdote about Dave Chappelle? Because he is one interesting ass ever.
Boy, Dave is like, being friends with Dave is like finding a unicorn, an actual real life unicorn. There's literally nobody that I know that is like him. And what's interesting is that he has never directly addressed, you know, him walking away from the Chappelle Show. But he has done like everything around that to make me understand, you know, what happened. Because of that, Dave's mentality is, a man like Dave, everything that he does, anything that you see him doing, he's doing it because it's something that he's passionate about and he wants to do his way and he's able to do it his way. And, you know, sweeter than, you know, that $50 million was, you know, coming back to the game and his first offerings, he saw $60 million. You know what I'm saying? Like, Dave... I put it this way. I remember the first time I ever went to his house and Dave was very instrumental in me even finding back my passion for music because I had lost it for a while because I'm like, hip hop is to me at the time. I was like, yo, hip hop is trash. Like, you know, I don't see myself in this mix of everything that's happening at the time. And, you know, one drunken night, it was just me and Dave at his crib, at his bar, and he's like, yo, I'm telling you that I am a massive fan. And if I'm a massive fan, that means there's millions of other people like me. And, you know, blah, blah, blah. We just went on to discuss it. And I thought it was amazing because if you know Dave Chappelle doesn't need anything from anybody. So he has no reason to just give you some random talks to boost you. And I remember before I left on the Monday, you know, I had given him some songs just off of my laptop. I'm like, yo, here, hold these songs and you know, just enjoy them. And I remember him opening his laptop and him saying, yo, check out this thing that I filmed the other day. And I watched about 10, 15 minutes of it. And I was like, Dave, this is hilarious. I was like, yo, what is this? He's like, you know, it's just something that I recorded out of my, you know, I filmed it out of my own money or what have you. Well, anyways, you know, he was like, yo, what do you think? And I was like, yo, Dave, it's hilarious. You know what I'm saying? Like, it is super dope. And he's like, word. All right, cool. No word of a lie on my kids. It wasn't more than 2 months later that Netflix announcement came out. And that same thing that he just had chilling on his computer, that was worth $30 million. You know what I mean? That's the type of magical life that Dave has. Dave is just one of those people. And I remember, you know, he put out two specials. And one of the specials, he used that same song that I put on his computer where I'm like, yeah, just enjoy it. He used it as the, you know, the music in the end credits, you know what I mean, for his special. So, I mean, being friends with Dave, this is the type of experience that you're going to have. He is one of the most giving, honest, passionate, generous, and what people don't know, most informed and intelligent Black men that you know. And I mean, I think with the special that he put out the other day, what was it called? 846? I think that's what it was. Like, yeah. that was just a glimpse into what Dave's demeanor and his energy and who he is. Like, you're always going to get comedy because that never turns off, but you're also going to get some of the most intelligent interactions ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And your song, actually, yeah, the song, your song called Reaching Through the Darkness, that's the one that appeared on his comedy special, Dave Chappelle, Equanimity. That's right.
Equanimity. Yeah. Yes, that's right.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and dropping so many gems, Cardi. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
So welcome back to our tea segment. And one of the hot topics of this week has been a lot of critique around the Raptors Game 7 loss to the Boston Celtics, particularly Pascal Siakam's performance. But of course, this devolved into racism. So immediately after the loss, somebody created a petition, a pretty like filled with racism and demanding that he go back to his country. Dalton, how are we ever going to address the, like, what I find so interesting about racism in sports is that athletes are often not even allowed to protest general racism without backlash. So I just feel like, how are we going to even address players being constantly subjected to it?
Yeah, no.
Racial abuse.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I mean, I think, you know, I'm not a happy camper for one, because Siakam, that's my boy. That's my dog. You know, this guy.
Yeah, didn't he win most improved player last year?
Yeah, he did. He was a key cog in the wheel. Like, he averaged, I don't know, like 17 points a game. Like, he played amazing last year. And if not for his contributions, we're not the world champs. You know what I mean?
Right.
But here's the thing. I think, you know, at the end of the day, did Siakam struggle during the series? Yeah, he obviously did, right? He played lousy in Game 7. You know, he didn't have a very good series. But so what? Who cares?
And there were other players that struggled as well in the bubble. Like, that's kind of what, when I was reading about this, he wasn't the only one.
No, he wasn't the only one. And here's the thing, Mel. I mean, what NBA star hasn't struggled or had an off game or series, right? People need to grow up. They need to smarten up. All of our sports icons have had terrible games, terrible series, terrible playoffs. So what?
Yeah.
You know, that just doesn't...
And the thing about fans is that this whole notion of, you know, I need to be entertained and seeing athletes as property is just such a... It manifests in every sport.
Oh, it really does. I mean, what we saw here is the same anti-Black racism, you know, that many delusional Canadians claim doesn't exist. It just reared its ugly head once again, right? I mean... you know, like I go to sports games, I go to, you know, soccer games, football games, I go to everything, even the Argos, even the lowly Argos. I check out games every now and then. And one thing I'll tell you about sports fans is that, you know, sports fans are fanatics, right? Like the word fan is a short form for the word fanatic. You know, so that's why you'll see people in Toronto running around painting their faces and torsos with their team colors. You know, it's absolute fanatics, right? So what we know is that, you know, what I would say, my personal opinion, is that many fans, they're not all together there, right? And right. That there are just as many racist pigs sitting in sporting stadiums as you'll see, you know, in your local grocery store, right? It's not like the NBA exists on a separate island from the rest of society.
Yeah, and I just feel like it's become such a clash with the movement because more athletes are speaking out. And I guess, you know, the administration of the teams have been, you know, they're saying they're listening, they're saying they're changing things from the inside, but it's hard to believe that when it's a structural issue and there's barely any Black ownership, barely any Black coaches.
Yeah, that's, and we like to, you know, I'm glad you raised that point.
Leadership.
Oh, no, for sure. I mean, I'm glad you raised that point because when you look at, you know, real measures of equality, you know, not these feel good moments, you know, we look at the courts and we say, hey, there are Black players or European players, but, you know, the facts are in the NBA. The NBA is like almost 80% Black as far as its players. And there's only like one Black owner, and that's Michael Jordan. And there's like 30 teams, Mel. 30 teams in the league, only one majority African-American owner, right? That those are the facts. Now, just you know, further to your earlier point, which is a good one, is that, you know, I got to thinking after seeing this kind of this blowback against Siakam, you know, go back to Africa, people calling him Gorilla, you know, on change.org. It kind of got me to thinking about how, you know, us Black cultural critics, we've been thinking about this kind of thing for a long time. This idea that, you know, when Black athletes can no longer, you know what I mean, like jump higher or run faster on playing fields, they just get cast aside, like yesterday's news, right? They get
degraded. Like they're discarded, like they don't matter unless it's about their abilities, which is really dehumanizing.
Oh, it's super dehumanizing. It's insulting. I mean, I remember at the AGO, I had to do this voting, this contest for this visual artist, this American visual artist. His name is Hank Willis Thomas, and he created this incredible piece of visual art where he portrays, like, you know, this football player on a playing field, and then he juxtaposes it with like a cotton field, you know?
Wow. That
was used during slavery, you know?
That's
so
powerful.
This idea of being the playing field being this sort of modern day cotton field, you know? So there's always this interesting discourse around, you know, Black men serving a bit of the same purpose as the transatlantic slave trade. And that's essentially to make money for mostly white business owners, you know, and just to be judged on your physical attributes, you know. So this is kind of what we see playing out with the Pascal Siakam situation.
And I also think it's interesting that Draymond Green was questioning why the Raptors would have Black Lives Matter on their bus when this is precisely why.
That is precisely why. It's Toronto Raptor fans that we're starting these change.org petitions to send Siakam back to Cameroon, to Africa, and call him a gorilla. These are being generated in Toronto, in Canada. So, you know, Draymond Green, yeah, anti-Black racism is a global phenomenon, my friend. It's not just restricted to the United States. It's time to wake up and smell the coffee, or wake up and smell the tea that we are spilling here today.
Thank you so much for listening. We want to thank our amazing producer, Ryan Clark. And you can find me on social media at Milena Williams and Dalton at Dalton Higgins 5.